Remakers Mark Special Episode 19, In Memoriam 2017. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Remakers Mark. Here we are in our 19th special episode, which is our annual In Memoriam episode for the year of 2017. It's been a little while here. Sorry about that. You know, life happens. Things happen. It's okay. Turns out we were uploading to the wrong internet. Sorry about that. My bad. But we're back now, and we're going to try to have some more regularly scheduled shows here. So
enjoy all those files, Russia.
Indeed. Turns out the dark web is really dark. You need a flashlight up in there. Whew. With me, as always, are my friends Andy Wicks. Andy, how are you doing? And frankly, what have you been up to the last 8 months?
I am great, and I turned 40.
Oh, hot dang. Damn. Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you.
Welcome.
That's a good one. Right on. Jeremy Nielsen, how are you doing, and what have you been up to these last few months?
I'm doing outstanding. I quit my job and sunk my life savings into opening up a store for board games.
Woohoo!
Well, I'll have to go check that out.
You should.
JK, I've been there. It's nice. It's super great. Say a little bit about it. What is it? Where is it? And where can people find out more?
Certainly. It's called The Gaming Goat in St. Paul, Minnesota. And you can find out more at facebook.com/thegaminggoatst.paul, probably.
Right on.
Or just search.
So the it's Gaming Goat, the Gaming Goat St. Paul, probably?
Probably.
Interesting.
I use the search function, as Jer mentioned.
Yes.
Very good.
The search function, Jer, is your friend.
Jer, I'm going to challenge you to get a official website in the month of February.
Done.
I would be happy to help you with that.
Okay.
I'm there for you.
All right.
My name is Kyle. Hi, how's it going? Just so happens that I have a bit more free time. The school that I work for just closed, so now I'm job hunting. So that's fun. That's a thing. That's my big goings on. Otherwise, you know, life's pretty good. I'm doing all right. It's cool. I'm happy to be podcasting and laughing my butt off with my best friends. So
yay!
I like this plan.
Just podcast more. Who needs money?
Yeah.
Food. Psh. It's all good. Mortgages pay themselves somehow. Lee Hallucination, how are you doing, and what have you been up to the last 8 months?
I'm great, and I spent 2 weeks in Europe back in September. It was my fourth trip there, and my first time in Italy.
Nice.
Right on. That sounds amazing.
Awesome.
It was.
I'm super jealous of that. That sounds fantastic.
It was.
Does this mean you get
fun
to be a citizen of Europe now?
I hope so. I'm working on it.
Excellent.
At least you haven't come back wearing berets yet. Ugh.
I would fully expect to be tased if I did that.
Yeah, but you are smoking constantly.
Yes.
No change there.
Those yellow French cigarettes.
Yes.
Yes. Yes, indeed. And Mark Josting, finally, how are you doing, and what have you been up to the last 8 months or so?
I'm great, thanks. Highlight of my last 8 months was probably asking my wife to expel an entire human out her nethers, and she complied.
Ooh. Dang. Did you like flip for it, or how did that conversation go?
It kind of went like, well, I guess it's you, huh? Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah. You're like, oh, thank God, I could never do that. That's pretty much my reaction to childbirth. Like, of all this toxic masculinity in the world, I was like, dudes, you know you could never give birth. Be frank. Come on. We would be miserable. We would never do it. The world would die like
yeah,
that.
I mean, we have a smaller hole and a longer path to get there, but...
It's true. Oh. It's true.
And this is the Anatomy Podcast featuring Mark.
Hi, hello. Nice to see you.
We'll have some illustrations on the website.
Oh, God.
Indeed. Oh, I'm going to have some fun with the links on that one. All right. Very good. Well, thanks for the catch up, guys. Good to be chatting with you for the first time in 8 months. It's like I never left. Now I'm going to hand the episode off here to Andy. Andy is our resident death expert for many reasons, but he just really likes
the med school
episodes. He went to med school.
Neither of those things are true.
Wait, what?
I didn't go to med school.
No,
sure
PT.
You did. PT is med school. It's the same thing. Why were you sleeping in that emergency room the other night? That's a different story.
Different reasons.
That's one for next year's In Memoriam episode. Yes, quite. All right. So, Andy, I'm going to hand it off to you and, you know, show us the way here.
I will show me the way. Thank you. This is our annual recollection of movie stars and entertainers and directors and other creative types that we lost in the last year. We are once again going to provide two picks, each one a bit longer one, and then we'll follow that up with a shorter one. Not shorter in terms, well, it could be shorter in terms of stature, more just briefer in terms of length. Certainly not an importance or anything like that. Mark's going to go first. And Mark, tell us about the entertainer that you would like to discuss.
Certainly. I would like to discuss from this breaks my heart that this that he's gone, but I'd like to discuss John Hurt.
Mm-hmm.
I'm gonna take a moment to sigh deeply for John Hurt.
Deserved.
Thank you. Yeah. John Hurt is, I mean, it probably be best to call him a staple of the sci-fi genre, but I think it's probably more accurate to say he's a staple of the everything awesome genre.
Mm-hmm.
He's probably most recognizable from his role in Alien, way back in the late 70s, as Kane, who was the guy that suffered horribly at the hands of said alien.
He had a wicked spaghetti allergy.
Yeah, yeah. Wicked case
salad,
of heartburn.
Remember? They were eating salad for his last meal.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Yeah.
Poor guy.
Yeah. And then in Spaceballs, it was the special.
Yeah. Yes, it was.
Because he played himself, reprising that... horrible, horrible stuff in Spaceballs. Anyway, yeah. I mean, early in his... Sorry, go ahead, Jer.
The special, that's what I ordered.
Uh-oh.
change it to the soup.
Good choice.
Yeah. By the buck, dummy!
Early in his career, John Hurt did lots and lots of stuff like that, and also like 1984, where he played Winston. But then he just got awesomer and awesomer as he got older. And later in his life, he made the most of being an old man. He played Ollivander in the Harry Potter franchise. He was Professor Broom in Hellboy, Adam Sutler in V for Vendetta. In Snowpiercer, he was the Elder Statesman Gilliam. He did a couple of awesome voiceover things in the Warhammer 40K movie and also... as a narrator in Dogville. And my favorite one personally is in Doctor Who. He was a special guest as one of the incarnations of the Doctor. And
I preferred him in his role in Halo 2.
Oh,
wait, who's he in Halo 2?
He was the prophet of... He was one of the prophets.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, right.
Yeah. I forget which one, but it was one of the prophets.
See, there's always some bit of awesome that you can bring up with John Hurt.
I bring up another one?
You may.
He was the voice of Aragorn in the original animated Lord of the Rings movie by Bakshi.
Ah, hot dang.
He was? Oh my god.
Yes, he was.
I owned that and I didn't even realize it.
I thought you were going to say that he was in Watership Down, because haven't you spoken of your fondness for that in the past?
Yeah, but I don't think he's in that, is he?
He is.
He is.
Yes.
He just there we go. Gets better and better.
Yeah, you can pull up all sorts of John Hurt from all over the interwebs. Yeah, and I mean if ever you needed the project to just be awesome, it seemed like John Hurt was a natural choice. And he always lent to it. He always added color and flavor. He just made your project better. And I'm sad that he's gone, because that means that projects will not be as better.
He had three projects come out in the year of his death.
Damn.
Yeah. He was a steady worker, that one.
Yeah, he was.
Mm-hmm. So that is my choice for the first part of our podcast is John Hurt. Another sigh. I'll miss you, John.
R.I.P. Mr. Hurt. Sir John Hurt.
Yeah.
Yeah, Sir John Hurt. How did I not neglect to mention that? R.I.P. Sir John Hurt. Andy, keep us sad.
I will keep us sad, and in the presence of nobility, I suppose, because I'm going to talk about Sir Roger Moore. Roger George Moore, is an English actor born in 1927. He is likely best known for portraying James Bond in 7 films over the course of 12 years. He is tied with Sean Connery for the most Bond films at 7 and is the record holder for the longest tenure at 12 years. But he also was known for many other roles. Probably his other best well-known role was playing Simon Templar in the original television series The Saint, which was remade into a movie with Val Kilmer in the early aughts, I think.
Yeah, sounds right.
Something like that. I think his canon, or his segment of the James Bond canon, is considered campy and cheesy in the context of the whole. But it also has my favorite James Bond movie. His movies include, starting in 1973, Live and Let Die, The Man with the Golden Gun in 1974 with Christopher Lee, The Spy Who Loved Me in 77, my favorite Moonraker in 1979, For Your Eyes Only in 1981, Octopussy in 1983, and A View to a Kill in 1985. Sir Moore was also introduced into humanitarian work by his friend Audrey Hepburn and became a UNICEF humanitarian ambassador in 1991. He was actually knighted for his charitable works. He also was married 4 times, was a tax exile from the United Kingdom for many, many years, and then passed away in 2017 from complications of cancer. So, again, Roger Moore in the Bond world is, I think, the silliest. And I think a lot of people would agree with that. And even I would agree with that. Mm-hmm. The writers, I think, because of Roger Moore's age, I think he was the oldest. I think he was 43 when he started playing James Bond. Let me think about this.
Well, he was 57 when he did his last movie.
He was 57 when he did his last one. He was in his mid-40s when he started. And I think they wanted to portray Bond as a little more of the like experienced playboy than the like rugged adventurer. And that's pretty clearly obvious in his movies. But Moonraker is just so awesome. Plus,
that's all you need, really.
I mean, yeah. And plus, he also was in his movies in which the character Jaws appeared. Actually, I think in The Spy Who Loved Me for the first time. But anyway, so Roger Moore is my first selection in our In Memoriam episode.
Did you guys hear the story that kind of went around after he died about the autograph that he gave to a kid? Did you hear that?
I think I heard that, but I don't remember the details. Do you remember the details?
Please tell.
The gist of it was that this kid who had seen James Bond movies ran into Roger Moore at an airport. This kid was with his grandpa. And the kid was kind of shy, so the grandpa went up and asked, said, like, hey, my grandkid says you're famous. Will you sign this for him? And Roger Moore was, you know, delightful and said, sure. And he signed it, Roger Moore. So the granddad brings it back to the kid. And the kid sees that it's obviously not signed by James Bond, right? It says Roger Moore. And he's like, oh, that's not right. He didn't sign the right name. He's James Bond. So the grandpa goes over and says, like, hey, my kid said that you signed the wrong name. And so Roger Moore, like, kind of realizing what's happening, like, waves the kid over. And he says, like, listen, I signed the wrong name because I don't want Blofeld to know that I'm here. So that's the reason why I didn't sign James Bond.
Oh, yeah.
And you need to keep that secret so that Blofeld doesn't find out. And the kid was like, okay. So then he went back and talked to his grandpa. He's like, no, I was mistaken. This is right. What he signed was right. He's like, okay. So just love it. It's just like,
that's awesome.
Because he became like a writer or something in Hollywood, didn't he?
Yeah.
I think
that's
how that, yes, I do remember that story now that you talk about it. What a great story. See,
yeah.
Roger Moore, and he spoofed himself in a couple movies, including The Cannonball Run, where he played a millionaire who was so obsessed with Roger Moore that he had plastic surgery to look like Roger Moore. I mean,
he introduced himself as Roger Moore.
He was very self-aware, and you know, anyone who's self-aware, I think is great. So,
yeah.
So, here's to you, Roger Moore.
Here.
I can only imagine you're drinking a martini while shushing down a chalet with 2 bikini-clad ladies at your side, because that's what James Bond would be doing. Your James Bond would be doing.
Good use of shushing.
Shushing. All right, Jer. Oh, Jer.
Yes, I'm here.
There you are. Tell us of your own version of nobility.
Certainly. My version of nobility is a far cry from a knighted
actor, but I chose for my first pick George Romero. George Romero is essentially the grandfather of zombie movies, coming out with Night of the Living Dead back in the 60s. And he essentially invented the zombie movie. Prior to him, zombies were not undead brain devouring, shambling corpses. They were much different and much less scary, I suppose. Yeah. And he turned them into what we know today as the zombie. We wouldn't have Walking Dead. We wouldn't have, pick a zombie movie that that's out mm-hmm. right now. We wouldn't have any of that without George Romero, essentially turning them into, or essentially using them as a satirical device to tell stories and give give poignant social messages. I would stand on the hill that Night of the Living Dead was meant to be a dark comedy and not a horror movie. But I think he's probably, besides that, he's probably best well known for his second popular movie. He, after Night of the Living Dead, he made a handful of horror flops, although The Crazies is still a movie I enjoy a great deal. Several years after Night of the Living Dead came out, he came out with Dawn of the Dead, mm-hmm. Which made him super famous and made all of the money. I think it was a $1.5 million budget, and he made $50 million or something on that thing. It was more or less his masterpiece, Dawn of the Dead. And then finally in his the closing of the trilogy was Day of the Dead, which was also pretty good. That was in the 80s. Whereas the other two were in the 60s and 70s, respectively. So he is one of the grandfathers of modern horror. And while I am not a big, huge fan of Night of the Living Dead, I absolutely love Dawn of the Dead and a handful of his other movies. And I respect what he has done for the genre and what he has done for movie making. As a storytelling device and in the special effects and department that that came out of his initial movies. So George Romero died back in July, and he died presumably from lung cancer. He would have been, old.
77, it looks like.
77, yep. So, he was one of those pinnacle figures in movie making, especially as it relates to horror. So, that is George Romero.
I love his IMDb profile picture, mm-hmm. because I wonder if that was the inspiration for the face for the main character in Up.
Oh, interesting. You know, I was thinking of the guy in Snatch who wears the huge glasses, gangster in Snatch.
Yeah, yeah.
Very similar.
Yeah.
Funny.
Nice. Yeah, that does look like Bricktop.
Yeah, Bricktop. There you go.
I forgot one last little anecdote about George Romero. When he first got started, he was his initial work was filming shorts and segments and commercials and things like that. And he actually, one of the very first projects that he was on was that he filmed a segment for Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, wherein Mr. Rogers goes to get a tonsillectomy.
Huh.
Which,
that's really weird.
When you think about it now, George Romero's Mr. Rogers Gets a Tonsillectomy sounds horrifying. So, but that was. I mean, you work where you work. So,
yeah, a job's a job.
A job's a job. even Mr. Rogers. So
kids weren't afraid of the dentist before that segment.
Yeah. So that is George Romero. And if there are no other comments, we will move on.
I would say that I think it's Dawn of the Dead is the second one, right? That's the one in the mall. My second favorite mall-based movie / scene behind the Blues Brothers chase scene.
I was going to say Blues Brothers has to be number one.
What about Chopping Mall?
Chopping Mall? That's decent. Is that the one that Chris Grapp talked about at his...
Chris Grapp loves that movie.
Yeah, yep. Yeah, yeah. Okay.
They did How Did This Get Made episode of that movie.
Oh my gosh.
And it's pretty hilarious.
It's awesome. Ridiculous.
All right. All right. Redirect. Kyle, yep. You are up next.
Yeah. So I'm going to be talking about Jonathan Demme. Jonathan Demme was born in 1944. He sort of came of his own from a filmmaking perspective in the 80s, where he had some pretty well-regarded comedies in the late 70s, early 80s. Melvin and Howard, Swing Shift, Something Wild. And then the one that kind of got the most attention for him at first was Married to the Mob, which is a pretty darn funny movie. He also has always had a hand in the music world as well. He made the Talking Heads music concert documentary film Stock Making Sense, which is, if you've ever seen the iconic image of David Byrne in the suit that is way, way, way too big for him, that's from that. And so he's always kind of balanced out the world of music and the world of filmmaking together. For example, he did the movie Rachel Getting Married in 2008, which had a lot of music in it, and would cast, I think it's Tunde Adebimbe from TV on the Radio, who is one of my all-time favorite bands. The lead singer from that band is one of the actors in there, and he has some he does some singing in that. It's quite good. He is most well-known, however, for directing kind of the 1-2 punch of Silence of the Lambs in 1991, and Philadelphia in 1993. So that he did those back and forth, or back to back, I should say. So that's a pretty huge, successful run there. He started out in the industry working with Roger Corman, which I think is pretty great. I just love how many people have did some stuff with Roger Corman in their time. I love that so much because it's just like so terrible and dirty and filthy. And everyone's like, well, that's what you start with. And everyone just says that that's fine. So I love that. The Stop Making Sense thing, one of my favorite stories in Hollywood is Steven Soderbergh, when he was making, I can't remember what the name of the movie is, but he was making this like sort of hard-boiled, very straightforward Hollywood detective movie. And then he had like a total creative freak out and left and made Schizopolis, which was one of my favorite movies. So Jonathan Demme had a similar thing where he was making Swing Shift with Goldie Hawn and Kurt Russell, who were a big item at that time. And just kind of, it just did not go well for him. He was not a super happy person after filming that. And so he took that break, did Stop Making Sense, and then it totally shifted his way of thinking from a musical perspective. So Silence of the Lambs completely cleaned up at the Oscars. It won every major category. There's only been 3 movies that have done that. I don't know what the other 2 are. Don't ask. But it won Best Picture, Best Director, Best Screenplay, Best Actor, and Best Actress, which is pretty incredible.
It's the first, wasn't it the first horror film to win Best Picture? Like, or like suspense thriller, I feel like that was.
I could see that.
A trivia point somewhere along the line.
Yeah.
We'll just assume I'm right.
We'll just call it true. If IMDb didn't tell me otherwise, so I'll think that's true. It became very much like a cultural tentpole as well, right? Everyone knows so many lines from Silence of the Lambs. And from a filmmaking perspective, he's very well known, both for music, which I've already spoken of, but then also his use of dramatic close-ups, which when you think about, especially Silence of the Lambs, the really tight close-ups of Jodie Foster's and Anthony Hopkins' faces throughout that movie just really brings you in there and just totally sucks you into the energy of that. Paul Thomas Anderson, who is one of my favorite directors, said that he is a huge influence to him. In an interview, Anderson said that the 3 filmmakers who had inspired him the most are Jonathan Demme. So he's clearly a big fan and frankly is PTA probably being the most... you know, well-regarded auteur director right now. Like for him to say that is pretty extraordinary. So Yeah, so he had a great career. I'm sad to see him go. He died on April 26th of 2017 from complications from esophageal cancer and heart disease. So he was not too terribly old, but you know, it was a shock nonetheless. So I'm happy that that he made what he made. You know, I have not seen Rachel Getting Married. I need to see that. That's like a gap in my film watching. So I'll seek that out. Yeah, I've heard very good things. I just love pretty much everybody involved with it. So yeah, I'm excited to check that out. But yeah, so check out his films. Watch Silence of the Lambs again if you're up for that. But it's so, so good, and he was great. So
Philadelphia was one of the first movies I remember that almost made me, like, that gave me an emotional reaction to the point where I had tears in my eyes.
Yeah.
At an age where I'm like, what the hell is this? What's happening? What's going on here?
Right.
Why are my eyes wet?
Yeah. Well, and just having that degree, like, I remember hearing about Freddie Mercury dying of AIDS when I was in, like, either sixth or seventh grade. Did you guys Something have Channel around. 1 at your schools? Do you remember that?
No.
It was a TV station that was meant to be beamed into schools throughout the nation.
Well, you didn't grow up in the fancy city like you did, Kyle.
Yeah, Brainerd. Pretty fancy. But listen to this, like, the people that were in it, it was Anderson Cooper, Lisa Ling. There's a bunch of people that, like, went on to, like, be legit broadcasters. But anyways, so they had a report about Freddie Mercury dying. And so that was kind of like my first, you know, admittedly very sheltered view of AIDS. And then Philadelphia was not, you know, a couple years after that, but not too terribly long afterwards. So, you know,
but just at an age when that topic was very differently perceived in the social world at the time. I think to make a movie about, and Philadelphia came out in 1993. To make a movie with very powerful actors in Hollywood at the time, Denzel Washington and Tom Hanks, and Antonio Banderas is in it as well. And I forget the actors who play the partners in the law firm, the older actors, but they're also these very well-established big names, is my point. But to talk about a gay man as the lead character, first of all, was, even like thinking about it back then when I was... she's ninth or 10th grade, maybe, you know, with a very sheltered, limited perspective on the world. But even me, remember thinking like, ooh, wow, they don't usually make movies about gay men, you know, like in the mainstream, and then a gay man with AIDS, like, whoa, what's going on here? Like I felt like there were a lot of social norms that were busted wide open with this movie.
Yeah. Agreed.
Moving along. Lee is going to wrap up the long pick round. Lee, tell us of your dead celebrity. Oh, it sounds so rough when I say that.
Rough and true.
Yeah.
Mine was kind of a very tragic one, because I think this is the youngest one on the list.
And very unexpected.
Yep. And that, of course, I'm talking about Bill Paxton. He was only 61 when he died of a stroke that was a post-op complication.
Man.
But the first thing I ever saw him in was Weird Science as Chet, the older brother, who was a complete bully and just a jerk. But honestly, of all the characters in that movie, that's the one that my friends and I still quote the most. Just all of his lines were just hilarious. And then, you know, as time went on, I started seeing him in more things like... True Lies. He was sort of a pathetic wannabe in that. He was in Aliens. And but I think for me, like, his best performance was in A Simple Plan, which came out, I think, in 1998 or 99. And that's just a great movie. It just, that one sort of flew under the radar. I don't think a lot of people went to it in the theaters.
I have a funny story about this movie when you're done.
But yeah, I mean, I think it was filmed in Minnesota, and just really explores, you know, the dark side of human nature and, you know, what money does to people. But I thought he was excellent in that, along with Billy Bob Thornton. And a few years later, he directed a really great movie that I was surprised at, because I had never heard of it until I think I just saw it on DVD and it looked interesting, and it was the movie Frailty. I think that was his first, like, major directorial project, and he did an amazing job on it. I thought it was a really good movie with Matthew McConaughey and himself, sort of a supernatural thriller. And I was really surprised by it, and I thought it was fantastic. So I was like, wow, this guy can do pretty much everything. Mm-hmm. But I've always been a fan. If you want to look up a really good interview of his, he did a speakeasy with Paul F. Tompkins. You can find it on YouTube. And it's just, you know, he just kind of talks about how he got into the business and talks about his dad and how his dad retired and decided that he was going to go into the business too. So he wound up getting an agent and just sort of walking into being an actor instead of struggling like he did. And it's just kind of a funny story. It's tragic that he died at such a young age. I'm glad that he did what he did while he was still here.
He just seemed like a regular guy in the way that most people in Hollywood don't seem like regular men or women, you know what I mean? Like, he just, it was like, he happened to be really good at acting, but he was just like, he was really good at high school theater, and then he just was like really good at college theater, and yeah. then he like went yeah. on to local theater, and then someone was like, hey, do you want to be in a movie? He's like, oh, okay. And then he's like, then in Hollywood movies. Like, he just, it never felt like he was putting on Hollywood airs at all.
Right.
Which I appreciate, you know, I think that's not super often that you feel that, and I appreciate right. it.
He was very down to earth. The yep. Texas boy. So
he was also really just he was one of those kind of chameleon like actors that could really just be anywhere. Like, he was the younger brother, just kind of the not quite dopey younger brother, but just the barely on screen younger brother in Tombstone. And then he was the drill sergeant in the Tom Cruise movie a couple years ago.
Oh, yeah. Edge of Tomorrow.
Edge of Tomorrow. Yeah,
he was good in that.
Yep. And, he was really good in that.
And then wasn't he the bad guy in The Postman with Kevin Costner?
Was he?
I never saw it.
Like, he could play villains. He could play good guys. He could play sidekicks. Like, he was just all over the place.
He's a leading man.
Yep.
And he could really just do a lot of different things, and he was one of those guys that you would start a movie and go, "Oh, Bill Paxton's in this."
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then
yep, he's that
and
guy.
And it just made it better. So.
Indeed.
Yeah, his iconic game over man in Aliens, like, that's just, it doesn't get any better than that as far as quotable lines.
Yeah, that was Chet from Weird Science was also my introduction to him, but it was Aliens that really made him pop. Oh yeah, I'm forever going to remember Bill Paxton now.
Yep.
Because game over, man.
Yep.
My family has a tradition of going to see a movie on Christmas Day, on the evening of Christmas Day, which is a very popular day to go see movies, turns out. But when we were first starting this, I think 1998 was maybe the second Christmas that we were doing this, and the movie that we decided to go see was A Simple Plan.
Oh.
Most of the movies that we've seen since have been more uplifting or entertaining, yeah. but A Simple Plan, yeah, while it is a great movie, it was a terrible movie to see on Christmas Day.
Yeah.
Like, we walked out of the theater just like, oh, I'm just going to go walk out in front of a bus right now. Like, it's yep. just was not a good choice. So it's kind of a running joke in my family about that one. Anyway.
You must have been thankful though, right?
Oh boy.
I was wrong. Bill Paxton was not the bad guy in The Postman. Will Patton, who is basically a poor man's Bill Paxton, was the bad guy in The Postman.
That's got to be a Bill stage Paxton. Name. You look like Bill Paxton, but we need a different one. How about Will Patton? How about that? Will Patton. There you go.
How about Schmil Schmaxton? I don't like that. Well, we'll work on it.
Sherry Bobbins. Let's move on to the short picks here. Jer, it's actually to you. Tell us about someone who I think is near and dear to all of us here, in that she appeared in a movie that is an episode that is yet to be released by us. That's an awkward introduction, but go with it.
Well handled, yay. I thought.
I was wondering where you're going with that. For my second pick, I chose the actress Glenn Headley, who passed away back in back in June. She was 62. She has been in a lot of movies that I really, really, really like, including, and this was sort of her big break movie, although it wasn't her first movie, but she was opposite Steve Martin and Michael Caine in Dirty Rotten Scoundrels as the target of their chicanery. And she played it well. She was fantastic. She kept up with the chops of those two from an acting perspective. And then she was in, and then she did a bunch of other stuff. And then she was also opposite Warren Beatty and Dick Tracy.
Yes.
She was Mr. Holland's wife in Mr. Holland's Opus, which was extraordinary. Mm-hmm. And she was extraordinary in that movie. And I believe she might have even won some awards for that. I don't remember exactly. But she is her resume is just out of this world. So much theater, so much film. She's been in a ton of stuff. All the way up until she passed away, she was working on a series, a Judd Apatow series on HBO, I want to say, called Future Man with Ed Begley Jr., and was only halfway through filming it when she passed away. So they carried on. They did finish the episode she was in and were then dealing with how to rewrite it because they didn't want to recast her character. So,
point of information, Future Man is a Hulu series.
Hulu, thank you. Have you seen it?
Not yet. It's on my list. I'm trying to get through The Runaways first.
Okay. But yeah, that's Glenn Headley. She is outstanding. She's everywhere and has done everything, and she'll be missed.
Totally. I love her. I love that she kind of flies under the radar, and I think it's just because she made it look easy.
Yeah.
And it's, starting off with Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, where it's kind of a holy crap sort of performance. Like, yeah, she can really act. And then every other role after that, just it seemed like she wasn't trying. But you know, how many people could do that sort of thing? It's kind also of like kind of like Sinatra singing. You know, it seems effortless.
Also, one other interesting point of fact: she was, prior to both of them being famous, she was married to John Malkovich.
Huh.
Dang.
Malkovich.
Huh. Malkovich.
She was in Babe, Pig in the City.
She was in Babe, Pig. I did not mention that one. But yes, she was.
Aw, I miss Glenn Headley. Mm-hmm. At least we have Dirty Rotten Scoundrels.
Yep.
She was so we'll bad. Always have Dirty Rotten Scoundrels.
We'll always have Dirty Rotten Scoundrels.
So true.
All right, thanks, Jer. Kyle, let's move on to you.
Yeah, so my short pick, although this totally could have been a long pick for me, was Harry Dean Stanton. He first came on my radar thanks to Alien, though he was in Godfather Part II before then. He's basically been in movies for six decades. I'll just read off a few here. Cool Hand Luke, Dillinger, The Godfather Part II, Alien, Escape from New York, Christine, Repo Man, Pretty in Pink, Last Temptation of Christ, Wild at Heart, The Straight Story, The Green Mile, Inland Empire, and then Lucky this year. So the one that it was first brought attention to was Alien, for good reasons. He has a very good death scene in that, which I very much appreciate. And the one that kind of is the one that made me appreciate him the most was a movie that, you know, I've talked about a bunch here, but The Straight Story by David Lynch. He's done a lot of work with Lynch overall, but he is sort of the MacGuffin of sorts of the movie, though he does end up being showed at the end, which is he is the brother of the gentleman who is riding his lawnmower from Wisconsin to Iowa or vice versa. I don't recall which, to see his brother who is basically dying. So he is the dying brother. And he has maybe like, I don't know, 3 minutes on the screen, but they're perfect. Like that moment has to pay off, and it does. He's just absolutely perfect. And he's just a everyman character. Like when I think of an everyman, and especially like a Southern-ish everyman, he is the one. He is absolutely the archetype of that to me. And I'm sad that he's gone, but man, did he leave a long illustrious career behind him. So Harry Dean Stanton was great. Watch all of those movies. They're all so great. And I just can't believe that he was a thread in all of that. project. So yeah, we will miss him, Harry Dean Stanton. And I guess Lucky was going to be one of those movies where sometimes you see people late in their career where it's like a career defining performance or a redefining performance. This was that. I haven't had a chance to see it yet, but it's supposed to be extraordinary. So with like Oscar buzz even. So that's pretty, pretty great. So yeah, Harry Dean Stanton was my wee pick.
He was also a lieutenant in the Navy during the Battle of Okinawa, I found out by Wikipedia. Wow.
Dang.
That's impressive.
That guy. I tell you, that guy.
I know. That's what I'm saying. With Bill Paxton and Harry Dean Stanton, we're getting the every man person up in there.
Oh, man. Mark, tell us about you're that guy.
I don't know if I'd call him that. So, Adam West was always a very recognizable personality. Or at least his name. I mean, right away in the mid '60s, he was Batman in the Batman television series. You know, the very very campy series, the campiest Batman of the campy Batmans. Yeah, I don't need to go on about that because we all know the Biff Bam Boom Batman stuff. And it seemed like I don't want to call his resume limited. But I'll call the source material for it limited. It seemed like most of his roles in a really lengthy IMDb listing are actually Batman. Or Adam West himself. He played himself in a ton of things. Probably most notably would be Family Guy, where he played a fictionalized version of himself as the mayor of Quahog. And I think that really speaks the most about... his personality, I think, is that he was willing to do that to himself in his own name, and it's awesome. Is yeah, I mean, chalk a lot up to Seth MacFarlane and the writers of Family Guy, but I mean that he as the mayor of Quahog was fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I am sad that that Adam West is gone. Just because I think he left a really big mark on Hollywood when he probably didn't have any good reason to.
Well put.
Yeah, so Adam West. Let's move on to you.
Well, my guy is someone who... worked a lot with Martin Scorsese, just everything gangster related seemingly, and that's Frank Vincent. If you're not familiar with the name, he was Billy Batts in Goodfellas, and he played, I believe, a similar character, I think named Frankie, in Casino, and then he was in The Sopranos. He was also in Raging Bull. And the funny thing is, in Raging Bull and Goodfellas, Joe Pesci's character beats up on his character or kills him. And then in Casino, his character gets revenge and ends up killing Joe Pesci's character, which I thought was kind of funny. When I saw that in the theater, I was like, oh, finally, he's getting back at that character. So, but, you know, he's got that presence of, you know, you look at him, he just looks like a gangster. He's got the square jaw, really rough looking, looks like a tough guy. And I think he fit that genre very, very well. So I don't know how old he was when he died or what he died of, but, you know, I think... He definitely left a mark in that particular genre, and I know that a lot of people will remember him.
Hell yeah.
Frank yeah, he Vincent. Is the perfect gangster, like, looking. Yep. It's amazing.
What else could he play? I mean, he was just built for that role. Yeah, not to say that he couldn't, because I bet he was a great actor, but he was just
he could have played Elliot Gould's stunt double. He looks a lot like Elliot Gould to me. Like in the Spaceballs sort of way, where they're like, that doesn't really look like him, but close enough.
In the Spaceballs sort of way. You know, in a really long shot.
Yes, exactly.
Oh, yeah. Oh boy.
But let's close it out with Andy.
All right. I'm going from one more to another more. This one is Mary Tyler Moore. And there's a,
so
there's
much
a,
more.
So, someone, three names instead of just two. Mary Tyler Moore has a close association with the city of Minneapolis through her TV show, The Mary Tyler Moore Show, which was set therein. So much so that there's a statue of her on Nicollet Mall, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is that where it is?
Mm-hmm.
Where she is, her statue is perpetually recreating the scene from the opening credits where she tosses her hat into the air, which really must have looked silly to passersby when just this woman just throws her hat in the air in a cold Minnesota winter morning. But anyway, Mary Tyler Moore was an American actress born in 1936 and most well known for the Dick Van Dyke Show, which ran from 1961 to 66, and the Mary Tyler Moore Show from 70 to 77. She also had a nomination for an Academy Award for Best Actress for her performance in Ordinary People in 1980. The Mary Tyler Moore Show held the record for the most Emmys won by a sitcom at 29 until 2002 when Frasier won its 30th, and I think then surpassed it from there. The Mary Tyler Moore Show featured not only Mary Tyler Moore, but Ed Asner, Valerie Harper, Cloris Leachman, and the Love Boat's own Gavin McLeod. That's right. Captain Steubing was on the Mary Tyler Moore Show. Did you know that? I didn't know that.
I did not know that.
Yeah. Mary Tyler Moore also was diagnosed with type 1 or juvenile diabetes when she was an actress, in her acting career rather, and later worked with the what was then known as the Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation, the JDRF, for quite a long time, and the ASPCA, among many other things. And she died from complications of pneumonia at the age of 80 last year. She has probably one of the most recognizable smiles in acting, I think we could safely say.
Yep.
So here's the hats off to you, Mary Tyler Moore.
Here, here.
In perpetuity.
Here, here.
Well, there we have it, folks. There's the 2017 In Memoriam episode. We're happy to kind of get back in the saddle. We have lots in the docket to get out to you that we're very proud of that just, we had other stuff going on. So anyhow... Remakers Mark is a proud member of the Math is Hard Network. To find out more information about this podcast or any other podcast on the network, check us out at mathishard.net. There you will find show notes with links to all of the people, movies, and links discussed in this episode, including those anatomical drawings we referred to earlier. Mm-hmm. This information is also attached to the show file in the podcast client of your choice. You can find us anywhere you listen to podcasts, including iTunes, where you can rate and review Remakers Mark, which would mean the world to us. We are on the social media. Just search for Remakers Mark and you'll find us. So please join in the discussion there too. Gentlemen, it's good to be talking with you again after 8 months of silence. Mm-hmm. Just kidding. We've talked just about every day. But it has been a while since we've said, may the force be with you.
And also with you.
Nailed it.
You don't have to say it so slow.
We're out of practice.
Low battery.